This is the Moonfest Destiny podcast, number 31. Moonfest Destiny is a novel I wrote in 1991. The subtitle is The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. My name is Peter Gelman. If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please go back and start with episode 1. Moonfest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents. I will now read chapter 30. Remember the Alamo! 3! The crawdads and pugilists shouted. I was getting the stick. Where was the carrot? Sergeant Mallory paused. I lifted my head and saw, out of the corner of my eye, my brother's restraining hand on his sergeant's shoulder. Before he could speak, Lieutenant Fisk stepped forward. Private Borginis, do you realize that disobedience, well-nigh mutiny, in the time of battle, can be a hanging offense? Therefore, the 10 lashes you are receiving is mild and merciful punishment. I let my head sink. Disobedience now could mean the death of us all, and what is worse, the failure of our cause. With my head gritted against the tearing pain of 3 lacerations, I did not trust myself to speak, to tell Kelly to get the hell away. I didn't want him to see this. I dug my fingernails into the rough wood of the rafter and braced myself. I glanced behind to see what was happening. Mallory pointed the whip at the water barrel. Kelly looked away. Fisk nodded. Mallory dipped the cat of nine tails, then shook water out in little flicks. Come on! Don't tarry. Let's get this over with, shouted Kelly angrily, stealing the whip from Mallory's hands. Crack! 4! The crawdads and pugilists shouted, as ordered. They were the ones who had also attacked the metal man. Crack! 5! 9 knotted strands of leather, water heavy, felt like a handful of hot coals pressed against my back. There, look at him, said Kelly. 5 is sufficient on my account, Lieutenant. I looked back as best I could. 10 is sufficient on my account, Lieutenant, said Fisk. Do you want me to? Go to the deuce, said Kelly, lifting the whip. Face front, he ordered me. Crack! It got harder and harder for me to hear anything but the whip after that. It cracked and cracked against my bloody back. I was dimly aware of the annoyed and insistent buzzing of flies, disturbed by the blows that opened the slow sluices of their whine. As my awareness receded inward, the more acutely could I feel the little pressings of their 6 legs on my sweaty face. At least some of them critters on my back must have gotten killed, I thought. Unfortunately, I did not lose consciousness. I felt every blow. Crack! 10! Got anything to say now, Borginis? Asked Fisk wearily. Yeah. Remember the Alamo. Remember the Alamo, shouted Kelly. My back was on fire. Remember the Alamo! Remember the Alamo! The agitated men picked it up, taking refuge in the cry. Remember the Alamo! They all meant it in a more rallying sense than I had meant when I recalled that slaughter, so much like this one. The odds against them was 16-1. Whereas, our odds were so much better, being 10 against our 1. "You'll be all right, Jack," said Kelly in my ear, cutting my wrists free. "This affair is closed," he called out. "Yes," agreed Fisk. "Yes," agreed Fisk. "And let us now hold in our minds the high example set by our dear Major." Kelly wrapped my arm around his neck. He slowly dragged me into the gallery. I stopped at the entryway, panting on the fresh air. "It hurts bad, don't it, Jack?" he said, licking his lips. "I don't mind you plugging that dang professor so much as making yourself so conspicuous in front of everybody. You made a bad name for yourself. Ain't no reason for asking for trouble. It's like you done it on purpose, Jack. What's wrong with you, boy? Don't you got no sense at all?" "Gol darn, but you are bleeding. I am awfully sorry about this, Jack. Awfully sorry. Let's don't tell Ma about it." "Don't tell Sarah," I said, although I knew this hard gossip was already known throughout the fort. "Don't jiggle me. Just hold still while I try to catch my breath." Outside, I saw Captain Holmes' silhouette by the flash of our mortar at Platform 3. "Sorry about getting blood on your gold braid there," I said. A music, running by clutching a message, stopped when he saw me. "Git!" cried Kelly, and the boy flew. "Jack," he continued, "will you promise me to mind your step now?" I thought about it. "No." Kelly winced, then said, "Tell me why you won't, then." "I'll tell you," I said, raising my voice a little. "Jacob Bentley." "Oh," cried my brother with annoyance, "but that weren't your fault." He knew the story, because he was also stationed at Camp Greenhorn when it happened. Only, when it happened, he was lollygagging with the boys in the officers' club, while I was right there on the hot and dusty trail. We were all green as apples, and Sergeant Mallory had the job of toughening us up for what we all supposed would be a good and lazy campaign of engine fighting. He tried to burn the baby out of us, as he put it, forcing us to march too many miles in the wet, smothering heat of a Maryland backwater July. We were hauling our muskets, Volta's piles, and packs up and down the hills, 100 gnats making black halos around our shakos, 10 miles up and down without water, 12 miles, 14. At 14, it happened. Joseph Bentley broke rank and ran ahead to the horse that was hauling all the water we were supposed to get at the 16-mile post. Bentley was pasty-faced underneath and flushed pink on top, but soon enough he was gray. He tore off his shako, dropped his musket and pack on the trail, and ran ahead. A holler went up through the ranks, and pretty soon there was a mob all around Private Bentley, who'd wrestled the water barrel off the horse and pried the lid off and dunked his whole head in. Sergeant Mallory waded through the mob, a big dimpled grin on his whiskered cheeks. "Well then," he laughed, hands on hips, "this gives us an opportunity to kill two birds with one barrel, so to speak. First, look at you. Behold yourselves and the perils of breaking rank. One man goes, and you all follow. One minute you're a formation of regulars, a phalanx. Next minute, and centurions become a bunch of schoolboys running around chasing girls. Well, I'll tell you, every living one of you would be brained by a tomahawk by now." We all laughed, Bentley too, dripping wet. "Have another drink, Mr. Bentley, sir," smiled the sergeant, giving us a wink that he couldn't see. Bentley looked unsure at first, but when the sergeant kept smiling and said again, "What's done is done. Go ahead." He smiled back and leaned to drink from his cupped hand. The sarge pointed to three of us, me being the third, and just said with another wink, "Give Bentley a hand, would you, boys?" We snickered because we knew what he meant. We were always having that kind of fun at Camp Greenhorn. We called it spirit. Stragglers get themselves tied to a tree. Bad marchers get themselves tripped and trod on. And sloppy dressers, like me, just once, would find themselves forced at bayonet point to parade at midnight in just their long johns. That was spirit, and that spirit filled us with its good fun as we grabbed a hold of Bentley's hair and arms, and we dunked his head down good and deep. The whole company started busting out laughing. Bentley began to fuss and fight something awful. He thrashed and splashed around in a frightful manner. But Mallory shook his head like Bentley hadn't learned his lesson yet. Mallory raised his thick arms so humorously, like a choir master. We laughed again as we picked up and hollered out, "Hail Columbia!" Firm, united, let us be, rallying round our liberty, like a band of brothers joined, peace and safety we shall find. It wasn't until the third chorus, when I was singing out, "As a band of brothers joined," that I got to feel anxious about our little game of spirit, for Joseph Bentley had left off his struggling. I wasn't the only one. By and by, the singing died down. Sergeant Mallory pushed us three away and brought up the dripping, slack-faced thing. He lost his grip, and Bentley splashed back in the tub then, his head bumping, thump, thump, against the wood as he washed back and forth. One too many choruses of "Hail Columbia" had cooked that noodle too long. We figured maybe he panicked and swallowed water the wrong way, and then in fright, something in his brain burst. He had drowned in 20-some inches of water. The War Department neglected to tell his folks that detail. They sent Sergeant Mallory south of the telegraph poles into the thick of the engine fight until it came time to defend the peninsula of Texas from the pesky Lunars. And Secretary Marcy needed every one of his 8,000 doughboys to march up a ramp into the gondola of a steam balloon. I felt awful bad, same as everyone else, about poor Joe Bentley dying on us like that. But I was sure, and everyone assured me, that I, Jack Borginis, me personally, was not so much to blame. And pretty soon it looked like everyone just forgot about it. Except after that, our spirit didn't have so much gumption in it at all. Up until the time he drowned, I was glad to be doing what I was doing to Joe. I wouldn't have broken rank if it wasn't for his bad example. I wouldn't have felt so thirsty all of a sudden if it wasn't for him. He was a foolish obstacle on my long road to glory. But ever since, it was like I was waking up, only I was waking up from a good dream into a nightmare. So I got myself whipped on purpose. I wanted Joe Bentley whipped out of my blood. I wanted that crime leached out. But maybe it didn't work. Just mentioning his name to my brother made me feel just as awful guilty all over again. It wasn't your fault, Jack. Just pass over it, Kelly whispered. That conspiratorial whisper was a shame-soaked hiss that stung my fleshless part. It was a steam burn on my soul, if I had one. So I swayed there feeling sick, dizzy, and dreary, not knowing what to do. I resisted his tug on my arm. "You believe in God?" I asked. We both looked up. Dirt trickled down. A mortar shell had thumped on the bomb-proof roof above us. We waited for it to blow. Nothing happened. He looked at me strangely. "Course," he said offhand. "Why?" We heard the shell roll off the roof and fall to the side. He sighed impatiently. "When you put it like that..." "Well, Jack, of course I believe in God. Don't everybody? Now we got to get your bleeding all bunged up, boy." I wouldn't move. "But why?" "Well, I figure it like this. It's like poker. I ain't got nothing to lose if it turns out God's bluffing. I'm bluffing too. And if there is a God, as of course there is, well, if I let him win, I win too, don't I? It's odds you can't lose when you wager belief." "God's got the dangest poker face I've ever seen, then," I replied. I was going to go on to say that poker seemed like a dang fool way to run a government. And that's what it was, wasn't it? Up in heaven. A government. A monarchy. Run by a mean, poker-faced river gambler. I was going to say this when just then there was an explosion. Kapow! The mortar shell finally burst. The music farther down shouted. In that instant, I owned up to the fact that I hadn't forgiven myself, that I wasn't going to forgive myself ever. Never. So nothing had changed. Almost. All my woe wasn't for naught exactly. My fleshless wounds, like my fleshy, could heal over with callous tissue. But the scar would always mark me a trespasser into evil. I'd be flogged forever, for I wouldn't forgive myself, and therefore could not change. That proud, maybe vain, self-assertion of wicked guilt in the nil gave me something, a vector in space, a laceration in flesh, a magnetism in a hunk of iron, a strength and a purpose, a godless and amoral atonement. The shell burst sent a torrent of dirt clods rolling down the entryway, and there, tumbled among the dirt clods, lay spilt the disinterred corpse of Gunnery Sergeant Oscar Rutherford Weigert. What a horrible sight. It was the headless hideousness, pale, broken, decayed. What a terrible caprice of chance. What a gallows humor prank did lawless nature please. to land her bomb on a dead man's grave when so many of us still living hid underground beside him? If war wasn't so gross and grim, it would be a farce. The worm had stupid, sharp-beaked agents, which refused to respect the proprieties of glory. I was so weak that the sight of that broken and chewed corpse was shock enough to drop me. Kelly lifted me and bore me swiftly into the infirmary. Reverend McKnight lay me on my stomach. Sarah washed my wounds, but would not meet my eyes. As night fell, on the 6th of May, I woke to the hot itch of my wounds and listened to the weakening sighs of Major Brown. Thank you for listening. Well, I'm remembering the chapter as I read it. It's been a long time. I do want to mention that the disinterment of Weigert's corpse did happen historically during the siege. I did not invent that. So if a writer is going to write about battle, how pleasant should it be for the reader? Not pleasant to be in battle. And the purpose of reading is, well, it can be different things. Certainly pleasure is one of those. So there is a problem. There seems a strong merit in resting on the truth, however. But as a story, it remains a question that I think is worth asking. Just as whether or not to use the N-word at a time when slavery was convention. And those who opposed slavery were outcasts. Kelly, Jack's brother, offered a proof of God. That was my casual vernacular version of what's called Pascal's wager. Pascal was a French philosopher and mathematician, 17th century. And this is his, what they call it, his wager, which is an approach to a proof of God. I'll read the Wikipedia version. 1. God is, or he is not. 2. A game is being played where heads or tails will turn up. 3. According to reason, you can defend either of the propositions. 4. You must wager. It is not optional. 5. Let us weigh the gain and the loss in wagering that God is. Let us estimate these two chances. If you gain, you gain all. If you lose nothing. 6. Wager then, without hesitation, that he is. In other words, that God exists. There is here an infinity of an infinity, happy life to gain, a chance of gain against a finite number of chances of loss, and what you stake is finite. And so, our proposition is of infinite force when there is the finite to stake in a game where there are equal risks of gain and of loss and the infinite to gain. So in more plain language, you got nothing to lose. Believe in God, because if there is no God, you'll never know it. But if there is a God, then you'll reap the rewards. Well, that's clever, but totally facile, because faith is not something that you can easily offer like a coin in a wager. I'm mainly interested in exploring the logic of that demonstration. Aside from the question of whether or not there is a God, which I'm certainly not going to get into here. Very rarely do I find such discussions satisfactory. Mostly they're at a pretty simple level, an insincere arguing from conclusion. I think more naturally fruitful, nonpartisan, honest, and probing discussions comes from the questions, does evil exist? What is evil? And is evil necessary? Why is it necessary? Shortly before I wrote this novel, there was a hazing incident in the U.S. Air Force that led to the death of one of the cadets. That helped inspire parts of this story. Now I want to read the first chorus of Hail Columbia. This is a patriotic American song composed in 1789 for the first inauguration of George Washington. Firm, united, let us be, rallying round our liberty, as a band of brothers joined, peace and safety we shall find. Immortal patriots, rise once more, defend your rights, defend your shore. Let no rude foe with impious hand invade the shrine where sacred lies of toil and blood the well-earned prize. While offering peace, sincere and just, in heavens we place a manly trust that truth and justice will prevail and every scheme of bondage fail. Thank you for listening. Moonifest Destiny by Peter Gelman is available on Kindle for 99 cents.